have to admit, it hasn't been easy. After all, how many times in life do you get to live out a fantasy? Ride your back end 3 times a week with this rock-hard 10-inch battering ram until your screams of ecstasy fill an entire stadium.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still Queer As Folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 12 of season 4, and it's called Irritation and Separation.
It first aired in the U.S. on July 4th, 2004. It was written by Brad Fraser, and this is his 5th of 8 episodes. His last one was this season's Preponderance of Death. That was Vic's funeral episode. And Fraser also produced 28 episodes of Queer As Folk.
Irritation and Separation was directed by Kelly Macon, his 6 of 11 episodes of Queer As Folk.
And here is a synopsis of Irritation and Separation. Melanie and Lindsay struggle to stay together in the aftermath of Lindsay hooking up with Sam Auerbach. Hunter and Callie have sex for the first time, but when Callie's parents find out, they appear at the Bruckner-Novotny apartment for a showdown.
After ghosting Emmett, Drew Boyd stalks Emmett and tries to woo him back. Emmett briefly falls for the hunky quarterback's attentions, only to have to call him out after Drew's wife contacts Emmett to cater their wedding.
After an action-packed sex scene with Justin, Brian decides to participate in the Liberty Ride in order to save the hospice.
I have something to tell you about this episode, Matt.
Go ahead.
I loved it.
Okay, I was actually a big fan of this. Like, I was actually having trouble finding a bottom to discuss. So,
me too.
This is good to know. Yeah, this is good.
Brad Fraser is a top-notch director, and Kelly Macon can really direct his pants off. And we've liked this combination in the past. This episode just came together perfectly. I was really, really surprised because the last 3 episodes or so, I was, what did Dusty call Melanie, a raging bitch? I was a raging bitch on the last 3 episodes, but this one redeemed itself. I was very happy.
Yeah, it managed to balance all of the jumping storylines very well to where I was like invested in what was going on. Some more than others, but it hasn't been like the last few episodes.
Right. I gave the A story to Melanie and Lindsay. Did you ID that as the A story too?
You know, again, it came down to the fact that we were able to jump through all the storylines rather seamlessly, that it was hard for me to find one that took precedence over the other. But we can definitely move forward with it being the A story.
Okay. So Melanie wonders where Jeffrey Pendergrass went.
This is a fucking catastrophe. What the hell happened to Jeffrey Pendergrass?
He felt he didn't have the support of certain influential members of the community, and that without their backing, he couldn't successfully meet the goals.
So he took off with practically every cent we managed to raise.
Bastard. We agreed to pay all his expenses.
Including hotel suites, champagne, and the kickoff party at Babylon?
Which he'd barely managed to cover, according to him.
Oh, I guess Brian had his number all along.
Did you notice that they swapped the Gay and Lesbian Center for the hospice? I guess the Gay and Lesbian Center wasn't important enough for a Liberty Ride.
But it was the hospice that was in danger of closing. The Gay and Lesbian Center seems to be doing fine. They were just acting on behalf of the hospice.
Sure.
If I'm understanding that correctly. But what also really bugs me is that... So Pendergrass's runoff...
Right.
And they're talking about how they might have to cancel the Liberty Ride because his fees were not covered. Somehow they ended up $25,000 in the hole.
That's a hell of a party. Because
and he screwed everybody over. And I the entire time I'm thinking, so Melanie's sort of the co-head of this whole situation.
She's the co-chair.
She's a lawyer.
Right.
Sue him.
Yeah, this is like yet another example of where Melanie is a terrible lawyer. And has no idea what the contract with Jeffrey Pendergrass said. I don't actually fault Jeffrey here. It's all on Melanie.
Yeah, like I'm assuming he, in order to make himself look legitimate, he had to have had a contract.
Exactly.
To explain exactly where all of his fees are going. You're going to tell me that she had no ability to streamline that and be like, hold on. I see a lot of problems with this. Let's make sure that we're all covered.
Yeah, right now they're like,
she's
gee,
a terrible
where'd he
lawyer.
Go? Where'd the money go? I don't know. Good job, Melanie.
Terrible lawyer.
So there's this children's birthday party where Melanie and Lindsay show up. And immediately Melanie is like, I'm going to just say cunty.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, Lindsay.
Sorry, I'm late.
Last minute Auerbach sale.
Congratulations on the show at the gallery.
Hey, it's been all over the papers.
It must have been a real thrill working with a famous artist like Sam Auerbach.
You can't imagine how attentive she was, tending to his every need.
She just can't stop taking digs at her. And would you do that in public, or would you keep it private without dragging all your friends and children into it?
I don't like airing my business in front of people, so I would try to make that as private as possible. But Melanie loves trying to embarrass Lindsay in this moment. It's such a turnoff. Like, the way this whole series has handled indiscretions like that is they have like an episode dedicated to it, and then everyone just sort of moves on from it. But here they're allowing it to kind of simmer, and it keeps coming out.
Melanie goes all bull-dyke on Lindsay in the kitchen.
I know which team I play on. It's not a choice or a preference. It's who I am. It's who I've always been. A rug muncher, a muff diver, a cunt liber, a bull, a lessee, a dyke.
What do you think I am?
Don't ask me to make up your mind for you. You have to do that all by yourself.
I'm a lesbian.
Not if you're having sex with a man, honey. Well, I'm pregnant yet. I don't know which betrayal to never forgive you for first.
Now I know where all the fan community anger has come from. Melanie could care less about Lindsay's infidelity, and she's entirely out of her mind over the affair being with a man. And I found that interesting.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I bumped on too. It seems like the series is really pushing to make sure that Lindsay has to choose a side. And now I'm understanding why a lot of fans have written talking about Lindsay being bisexual. Like, I'm buying that a lot more. Or in that she is bisexual, or she at least has experimented, and that's okay. And we should all recognize by now that gender and sexuality is fluid, and that Mel should have been much more upset at the cheating, period, and not just with whom Lindsay cheated. That's the huge problem.
I mean, I think I might be a little surprised if my partner all of a sudden hooked up with the opposite sex, but I don't know is that I would turn it into the overriding thing. It'd be more about the infidelity of it all. It's like you can hook up with other people, and that is a separate problem than like, but it was with a man.
If Sam Auerbach happened to just be an amazing female artist and she had cheated on Mel, it goes back to that the issue in I think in the first season when
Lita,
and that was a whole issue.
Oh, wait, who hooked up with Lita? Oh, they all hooked up with Lita, though, remember?
Yeah, they all hooked up with Lita. But Lindsay was very upset at the fact that Mel was wanting to experience that again. I don't know if it's because they had the prior relationship, and that's where Lindsay's jealousy stemmed from. However, now let's see what it's like when it's on when she was on the other foot. However, that foot still happened to belong to a man.
I think the dykes just need to like have an open and honest relationship and fool around with other people. People.
Like there's nothing wrong with that. Exactly. Right. There's nothing wrong with that. But have the open discussion.
I thought the storyline got a little convoluted when Dusty came in and made her raving bitch comment.
Bad timing?
No. We were just having a discussion.
You don't have to explain it to me. I've had three. There's nothing like a good pregnancy to turn you into a raving bitch.
It was almost to say, Melanie, you're overreacting because of the pregnancy. And then I started to think, I wonder if this really is because of the pregnancy where she's going crazy, or whether she really felt this all along. And I'm kind of left thinking, yeah, she kind of felt this all along. It's like, dyke. That's it. Period. No men.
Yeah. This whole push to absolutely define who Lindsay is compared to who Melanie is. Let Melanie feel 100% secure in who she is.
You mean Lindsay?
I'm talking about the way Melanie continues to use those terms to 100% describe who she is, but that's not her decision to then say, okay, but Lindsay, you have to ascribe to exactly those terms as well.
Right.
To tell me who you are. Like Melanie or what Lindsay is allowed to feel confused or given to this moment to only confirm what she was having doubts about.
Yeah, Melanie is always a little bit of a know-it-all too. She's always pulling these lines like, you don't live with somebody for 9 years and not know. It's like, yeah, you do. Yeah, that can happen.
But she didn't know enough to look at a contract with Jeffrey Pendergrass. But anyway.
Right. So Melanie apparently camps out in the diner all day. Doesn't she have a law practice to get to? She had breakfast at the diner. Then Debbie serves her lunch. And so she's been there for like the half the business day. Nobody wondered where she was.
Wasn't there a period at her law firm where that because she was pregnant, they thought she was doing too much? So like they weren't.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they
can't
really, they can't really bar her from going in. But I'm sure they probably would have made a fuss about her being there while pregnant or something. I don't know. They're just trying to make sure that Debbie has her moment with her, too.
It's interesting because we don't see Melanie's workplace really ever again. We saw it a few times early on. She must go to the local WeWork facility now. Because she doesn't like seem to go to the office ever. Something I didn't like about that scene with Debbie in the diner is that Debbie totally shied away from Melanie's problems with Lindsay. And that seemed atypical for Debbie to not stick her nose into it.
It's Lindsay and me. We're in trouble, Deb. Real trouble.
Stop right there. I don't want to know. Because whatever it is, doesn't matter. What matters is you're about to have a baby.
Yeah, she like made a very strong point to say like, that's none of my business. It's like,
and her advice was wrong, though.
Wait a minute, everybody's your business. That's
your role.
About?
You were cast as the busybody of Gay Pittsburgh.
You are the mother of the series.
Right.
Like this is where you come in.
Well, and her advice to Melanie is everything's all about the baby and everything, but it's not. It's equally about the relationship, too. So I think Debbie was off the mark there.
Absolutely. Do you want to bring this baby into a possible toxic relationship situation? If you know this, if this marriage is going to fall apart, are you what are you going to be prepared to do when this child comes? Because clearly you are far too along to do anything about the child now. So,
and I guess that was Debbie's point, but she was very like, one-dimensional about it.
Yeah, there was no nuance to how this conversation should go. To just like say, I don't want to know about it.
Right.
What? You want to know about everybody else's business? That doesn't make any sense.
So later that night, in Melanie's third meal of the day that we get to see on camera, we see Lindsay is cooking dinner for Melanie.
Like, this is also the one time where I feel like I've seen Melanie where I'm like, oh, you are pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
This entire time it's been like maybe, maybe not, little bit, sort of. Now she's all like, could go at any time. I'm like,
so Melanie snaps at Lindsay after enjoying her meal.
I actually thought you decided to forgive me.
You must expect miracles or amnesia. Well, I'm sorry I can't give you what you want, but that's par for the course, isn't it?
What's that supposed to mean?
There's nothing I can do that'll ever make you feel completely happy. You'll always feel unsatisfied and I'll always feel like I'm not enough.
That's not true.
Oh, bullshit, of course it is. Otherwise none of this would have happened.
Mel!
Do you think that this was like a pregnancy mood swing? Because Melanie is seeming like super unhinged.
Yeah, she doesn't want to even be touched by her. Which, okay, I kind of understand the hesitancy to say like, I forgive you. Like, there's something to be said that someone came into a sacred space and like, how do you go forward with it? But they don't do a great job of building those stakes. It just sort of snaps. So then it only feeds into what you're talking about where, yeah, it feels like it's just her hormones because she's pregnant is all out of whack.
Yeah, it's like one of those TV commercials where you see the bipolar woman. She's sitting in her office and all of a sudden the roller coaster like bursts through the window of the office. Then she's on the roller coaster. Then she's like out binge shopping and she's just like completely different than what you expect her to be. She's still holding it against Lindsay that it was a man. And it's like, yes, we get it. We know. We understand. You don't have to keep bringing it up over dinner. But and then she collapses at the stairway.
Yes, there's like an oof and ooh.
And we find out that she's going to stay in bed until the baby is born. She's got to be close to the due date by now, right? Is she like in the last month? Is she in the ninth month?
It must be. If they're now saying bed rest and that she went into early labor, but they managed to stop it with drugs. I feel like that's such a simplistic way of saying like, okay, but this is how we made you better, by just giving you drugs. Like,
yeah, I bumped on that too and I looked it up and I guess that's a thing. There's certain ways that they can head off a premature baby. This was kind of like magic wand stuff though. So
yes.
I guess it's medically possible, but here it was just like, yeah, we gave you a pill.
Yeah, it's like you can hear the writer's room just going like, yeah, is there any way to stop that? There is. Can you Google that? There is. Okay, great. Yeah, let's go ahead and put that in. Like that's what it was.
Totally. So they get home. Melanie gets into bed. Something I wondered about is, they put the bed down into the salon, the sitting room, the living room. And then I thought, why not just leave her in the bedroom, right? And then I thought, okay, maybe there's like a TV down there, or maybe there's more to do down in the front room. But that started to seem almost like a colonial thing. It's like, well, when you're time to have the baby, we move you to the bed in the living room.
Yes, they have Michael bring down the bed.
Right.
Like, I'm sure you probably could have got, like, she could have taken stairs and then just stayed up there.
Well, and immediately Melanie gets up. She gets into the bed. She talks to Lindsay. Then she gets up. She needs a bottle of water. It's like, what?
Like, did you know? She doesn't listen to anybody.
Yeah.
Doesn't listen to a damn thing.
Well, and at this point, Lindsay is still giving it an honest go. She's trying to hold it together, and she seems aware that Melanie is in a precarious, very pregnant state, and she's not going to do anything to totally upset it other than have sex with a man. But she didn't do that to upset Melanie. Melanie is still basically headed towards the door, though, and this story started to get interesting.
How so? Because she's ready to leave?
Well, we keep seeing cliffhangers with the lesbian stories, which we generally aren't getting with the gay characters. We had Brian's ball. That was like the last one.
Yes.
That's really it. This is like some good episodic TV writing where you don't know what's going to happen, but you really, really feel like you have to tune in next week to find out. Still queer as folks, stick around. We got a lot more to talk about tonight. Story of the night is Hunter and Callie. I was digging this story. So it's a Meet the Parents event. It's parent-teacher conferences. I thought it might have been a little presumptuous of Stephen Leeson and Amber Morgan Leeson to single out the two guys together and say, oh, gee, that must be the gay couple whose kid is dating our daughter.
Excuse us. Are you Hunter's parents?
Yes, that's right.
We're Callie's folks.
Callie.
Our kids are seeing one another.
Yes, of course. Famous Callie.
Steve Leeson.
Amber Morgan Leeson.
Ben Bruckner.
Michael Novotny Bruckner.
Okay, yes. So I was trying to figure out how they knew that, and I figured it had to have been because they were leaving that classroom and maybe they had overheard the names. Maybe. They heard, oh, Hunter, blah, blah, blah. Oh, that must be. And I mean, clearly they knew that clearly he has two fathers. So maybe that's how they
just
did
picked
it,
the nearest two guys together.
Yeah. I mean, because I highly doubt there were a lot of gay parents in that high school at that time.
True. I mean, I like the idea that you just said that, you know, they call like roll, or maybe there's like a schedule posted on the door or something.
Yeah. But my favorite thing was after Callie's parents introduced themselves and Callie's mom hyphenates her name, that Michael also hyphenates his last name. It was like, he's apparently Novotny Bruckner all of a sudden. And I kind of wish Ben had been like, what the hell are you talking about?
I took that same note. I noticed when he did that, and I thought that he was being sassy. And that was the note that I put down. Michael was a little sassy. And then my next note was, Ben didn't even bat an eye at it. It would have been nice to have Ben raise an eyebrow and kind of look at Michael and go, aw. But he just like...
just kept going.
Right.
Just keep going with the scene. Nothing caught our attention there.
Exactly.
But yeah, it was such a really nice little meet cute. You know, that like I thought that Callie's parents would have been turned off by the fact that they were two men, but that didn't seem to.
They seem like a hip urban couple.
Yeah, you know, they're not like regular parents. They're like cool parents. Right. You know,
and Steve was wearing really leather.
Yes, and they're very excited.
Yeah, let's plan evening together.
Yeah, they're very excited to get together. They're happy to know that, you know, those two kids found each other.
Is that still a thing? Do like parents that are of kids that are dating each other, do they still like get together or like want to meet? Does that happen?
That has not happened to me since I was in college.
I don't think it's ever happened to me.
I mean, and since then, no. I mean, I know my boyfriend's mom wants to meet me. That's about
uh-oh.
It.
That can go one of two ways.
Yeah, I'm very curious. I'm very curious to see how that's going to go. But yeah, that's all that's happened with me so far.
You'll do fine. You're a fine, upstanding young man.
Oh, I know I am. Moms
love you.
Yeah.
And dads want to be you.
probably not. I think the one thing that she has sort of, she took like slight pause is just that there's an age difference between us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was a little bit like, he's how much older than you?
And then you just say, it's okay. We're in the same place in life, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We are both adults. We both have jobs.
You have your own apartments. Fine. Yeah. Exactly. You make your own way in the world. So that's very unlike Hunter and Callie. And so they immediately fall into bed together. Callie says that Hunter has nice big lips.
Which he does.
Well, when I watched that the first time, I was half asleep because I watched the episode once to warm up to it. And then usually like later in the day, I'll watch it again and take my notes on it. And so I was half asleep when I watched it the first time. And I could have swore that she said dick, not lips. And so I went half the day thinking that she said that Hunter has nice big dick.
He just has young dick.
Yeah. Well, then I watched it again. She didn't say that at all. It was totally about his lips. And she also said that he has a cute ass, but honey, he has no ass.
He has no all. Ass. None. None whatsoever. That's why his pants continue to hang off of him. There's nothing to, catch it.
Well, yeah, I thought that too. And then I've often noticed that back in my wayward youth, skaters that would wear big baggy pants at the time generally had really good butts underneath those. And so Callie actually had her hands on the goods. So she would be more in a position to say that it was a nice ass, whereas so far we just see big droopy pants on Hunter.
Right. Those diesel jeans are not quite working.
Those were so not diesel jeans. It's like Michael lied. They didn't buy him diesel jeans. I thought that Hunter handled his status question pretty well.
Before we deal, there's something you should know. I'm positive.
Positive? You mean
I have HIV?
Shit. Are you all right?
I'm not sick or anything. It's just there. Inside me.
I was super impressed with how this scene was handled. First of all, that Hunter is being responsible with Callie and telling her before they go forward. That was amazing. And then to have Callie be a very supportive person in that moment, it really speaks to how informed the younger generation can be about sex when given the right information.
Or she was just like really hungry for the D.
Well, here's the thing though. Like She thought it through. She said, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. You know, she was first kind of apologetic, which is a little bit of a turnoff because it's not really something to be sorry for. But then to understand, like, here's how we can be safe here. And, you know, at first she asked, like, how did you get it? You know what? You don't have to tell me. And then to still want to be there with him and do that. I mean, it was really, really impressive to see that moment happen between two teenagers. And I think is actually a really powerful thing to have on television. To try and at least help with the stigma that still exists with folks who are HIV positive.
But don't you think that they should have had that conversation outside of having their underwear off with each other for the first time? But they're kids, so I guess I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on when they have their discussion about one of them being positive.
Yeah, I mean, it's also the first time that Hunter's had to confide that information.
Yeah, tell anybody.
Yeah, and it's also probably the first time Callie's ever had to be faced with it. So first time for everything.
I thought Harris Allen played this scene really well. I commented on this in the last episode, but he plays Hunter as really vulnerable these days and unsure of himself, a bit scared. He really put a nice touch on this scene that was kind of surprising because, like, as you know, Hunter is not my favorite character, but Harris Allen acted him like tremendously well here. And I started to warm up to Hunter. I was like, oh, I kind of like Hunter now.
I'm glad you said that because this is where I fell in love with Hunter as a storyline and especially how Harris Allen is playing this. Like it was just very truthful, very vulnerable. And you know, you buy it. You buy the whole situation.
Right, yeah.
It's a very strong moment in the series.
By the way, Meredith Henderson played Callie Leeson. She was in 5 episodes. And having a female character introduced into the story made me wonder, what happened to Daphne?
Oh, my God. Did she graduate? Is she still in school? How long has it been?
I think we last saw her in that Cody Bell episode where she was going to go to her straight room with her straight soda. I don't think we've seen her since then.
Oh, wow. Man, it's been Pink Posse since? Wow.
It would have been cool if Hunter fell for Daphne.
Aww,
I think Daphne's older, though. Daphne's in college. Older women.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, so it wouldn't have been as appropriate.
So Steve Leeson calls Michael for dinner. He was able to track Michael down to his place of business.
I mean...
I'm not surprised they snoop on Callie. If he was able to find like Red Cape Comics and know that Michael worked there.
That owns it.
Right.
I mean, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that. I don't know why in my head I was like, oh yeah, they're just calling him at home.
It's kind of funny because these like little details I picked up on only on the second watch through. Like the first time I was just like... went right through it. And so I think that's a good sign of great storytelling and good writing where you don't notice some of these like weird incongruities or these weird things that are just not going to happen in the real world. But do you think that when he set up that dinner that with the Bruckner Novotnys, that they had already read her diary and their only point was to go lower the boom on Hunter? Or do you think that they were still in like full on dinner, let's get to know each other mode?
I'm glad you bring this up because the phone call tells me that it was just going to be, yes, we're still on for dinner. That works. That's great. But then we jump into why they're there. And then it turns out that I think that's unclear. Like, because now they bring up Callie's diary that explains that she had sex with Hunter and he had told her that he was HIV positive and they had safe sex. And I'm glad they also brought up a point of like, you've read her diary, so you don't have any respect for your daughter's privacy.
Right.
Cool. but then her dad says like, kids today, you do what you have to. And it's like, it's not a great example.
Well, something that got my attention here is that the Leesons went to Hunter's parents to say that they wouldn't allow their daughter to date Hunter. But isn't their first move to tell Callie and forbid her to see him? It seemed pretty aggressive to go talk to this kid's parents.
I'm wondering if that has to do with Hunter's status more than anything.
I mean, it would be one thing if their daughter ignored their wishes and kept on seeing him anyway, but that apparently hasn't happened yet. She was like all too willing to keep seeing him. Instead of like saying, Callie, you may not see this young man again. They like go to his parents and say, we have decided that Hunter cannot see Callie.
Yeah. You know, you almost wish that we had seen the dinner scene and then that's where it comes up or that it slips out or something like that. And
oh,
then
yeah. That would have been great. Like this
that
awkward
would have been fantastic
dinner moment.
Yes. Of Ben says, oh, did you take your medication or something? You know, something
right.
Like that. Something that lets it slip out and then we have to deal with the repercussions of it. But then you have Callie saying like, oh, I know he has it. He told me this is how we protected ourselves or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Something to that effect would have been amazing to watch with everybody there. But instead, yeah, we get this moment, this confrontation that sort of just happens.
Did you think that it was not helpful for Ben to disclose that he's HIV positive too? That didn't seem like it would have helped their case at all. He just had to like work that in.
Yeah, I have no idea how upset we were. Your son may have exposed our daughter to AIDS.
Hunter doesn't have AIDS. He's HIV positive.
What difference does it make?
Very big difference. I ought to know. I happen to be HIV positive too.
Well, I think he brought it in. He brought it up because he's saying like, you're also talking to someone who is HIV positive and who has clearly lived as normal a life as you can. So let me explain to you, as someone who deals with this day in and day out.
But he didn't.
I think he tried to, but then you have the parents who, and it's incredible how uneducated her parents seem. They think that Hunter has exposed her to AIDS, which he doesn't have. He's HIV right. positive. He does not have AIDS. And then it reminds me of what sad state of the world is still in, because this is still a stigma that exists in our community to this day. Even with all of the drugs that are out there, with all of the new education and all the new research that is out there and about how normal it can be to live with HIV and how to date someone with HIV and how to have sex with someone with HIV, that
somehow to this day, there's still people who believe exactly what Callie's parents believe. I mean, hell, I even remember going on a date with someone who made such a big deal about him being HIV negative and how he would never date someone who was HIV positive or have sex with someone who was HIV positive. On the first date, he brought this up. And I was like trying to be like, oh, I mean.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, suffice to say, that was a one date only situation because I think I had told him that I had had sex with people who are HIV positive, and there are ways that you can do this without.
Yeah, you've told that story on this podcast.
Yeah, before. Yeah, because I was gonna say like I couldn't remember if I had brought it up before or not, but I mean it boggles my mind. I am much more comfortable. I would say I'm almost more comfortable having sex with someone who is HIV positive than I am with someone who claims to be HIV negative.
One line that reinforced our opinion of the Leesons was that they asked how Hunter contracted HIV, and that's a pretty gutsy thing to say to somebody that you just met.
How'd he get it anyway?
That's a private matter.
He had sex with our daughter. I think we have a right to know.
And I also, okay, so yeah, let's talk about that moment. So Hunter lets Callie's father have it and saying that he clearly knows more about what it's like to live with HIV than he could ever have, and he storms off. The teenage aspect of it really handled itself really well. Like, he doesn't feel like he has support from either side, from either his parents or from Callie's parents. And so he storms off. And then they ask him, how did he contract it? And I'm glad that Ben says, because like, that's a private matter.
Hunter had left the room at that point. And mm-hmm. that was, and I kind of thought that it was like bait to get Hunter to just unload the truth on the and Leeson Morgan. Morgan Leeson.
Yeah, and for them to say like that's our daughter, so we have every right to. I was like, no, actually, you still have zero right to know how that happened. That's absolutely still none of your business.
Especially because it doesn't change the circumstances at all. It doesn't matter how, right?
And so then when he busted out and said, "Why don't you tell them?" or "Should I?" and then it cuts away. I was like, "Wait, did he tell them?"
Well, there's something. One line in this scene that I thought was weird was when Michael says,
"Excuse yourself." Go on.
That line should have gone to Ben, because Michael still comes off as a kid half the time. And I think Ben is more of the adult in the room. And so it just seemed like Ben should have had that line instead of Michael.
Yeah, this whole conversation feels like this should be Ben led.
Yeah, because Michael was in adult mode, only kind of not quite, but almost. And it was kind of a awkwardly staged scene, but I like the content of it. And I like the way that this played out. So the next day, Hunter and Callie run into each other at school. At first, I thought for sure they were in the hallway of the Degrassi Community School.
It looked just like it.
Well, I looked up pictures.
And I got real excited.
And I looked up a couple episodes. It wasn't. But I was like, oh, that would have been so great if we like had this loose tie-in or they borrowed the set or something like that.
JT York walks by.
Right. Maybe that's why we liked Hunter and Callie's story here, because it was so like ripped from the headlines of Degrassi.
Oh, it's so Degrassi.
Yeah.
It's absolutely so Degrassi. It's great.
So Ben, Michael, and Hunter have a talk.
What girl's going to want me when she finds out what I got and how I got it?
You'll find someone. You'll see.
Just like Michael and I found each other.
It's different with a guy and a girl. I mean, someday she'll want to have kids. I can never do that.
That's not true. They're working on that.
Never should have told her. That way no one ever would have known.
Oh, you did the right thing. The honorable thing, telling her the truth.
No one's ever going to love me.
Oh, God. That's not true. We love you. Whether you're positive or not. Whether you're gay or not.
Too.
I felt like Ben and Michael could have said a little bit more to comfort Hunter, but still it was useful for Hunter to start realizing the harshness of everything that surrounds him and his status when it comes to ill-informed people. I just wish that we might have heard some better advice from Ben and Michael, or like a better future that they both see, but they were just kind of consoling him and not really offering alternatives. And I didn't mind the scene so much, but I just kept thinking of ways that it could have been different or better.
Oh, I thought emotionally this landed really well for me. I thought it was, first of all, again, Harris Allen is like nailing what it's like to go through your first heartbreak. And
at age 16.
That's a thing.
Yeah, totally.
Teenagers go through it. Yeah, like it is. That is rough. And especially when he met someone who he believed could stand by him, knowing that he was HIV positive and the way that she cared for him in that regard. But then it's the fact that of how he contracted it, that that's what turned her off to the whole thing. And to then hear him say, no one's ever going to love me, that cut deep.
Well, was Callie really turned off to it at this point?
Well, at least in this moment, we're assuming that she ended things because of the fact that he had had sex with so many men, and that's why she couldn't get out of her mind was how many men he probably had sex with, and that he did this. And she wasn't as sympathetic as she was just hearing that he had HIV. In her mind, it never occurred to her. She thought it might have been like a transfusion, or the fact that she thought drugs or something like that before hustling. It felt like she had scenarios in her head like, oh, I can handle it. I can handle it. I can handle it. Oh, you got it through numerous anonymous sexual encounters. And she was going to give up her virginity, even though virginity is like a whole.
Shari gave it up.
It's a bullshit thing that I wish we would all forget that word. I think that's where her line was, and it didn't know how to reconcile that. So then that just left Hunter with like, this is what my past is. And am I always going to be constantly judged by that past? And yeah, so I preferred that they didn't have to offer sage advice. They were just there for him.
Yeah,
like letting him have this moment, and I that's what I really loved about it.
I thought that Hunter could have at least told Callie more about the how and why that he got into prostitution, because
that like his mom pushed him into it.
He was pimped out by his mother.
Yeah,
and then it was to support himself after he escaped from it. It seems like it's a more approachable story to somebody like Callie when you get the more of the why. Because it makes the truth a little bit easier to deal with. But he didn't really get the chance to explain anything. And
there's only so much time you can get between the bells at school.
That's true. Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. So we had two runners tonight. The first one, I'll just call Brian, gets on a bike. So he gets a clean bill of health. The doctor says he can do light stretching and mild cardio.
You put on some weight.
I realize to you that's a good thing. To me, it's a disaster.
How long till I can resume a normal life? Doing recreational drugs and consuming vast amounts of alcohol. Going to the gym.
I don't have any problem with some light stretching and mild cardio.
Doc, I'm a fag. I don't go to the gym to be healthy. I go there to look good. Light stretching and mild cardio aren't going to cut it.
Brian, you've had cancer. Your body's been through a series of radiation treatments. I suggest you take it easy. Give yourself time to recover. After all, you're not 21 anymore.
Not only was that setting up Brian's eventual bike ride, but it also kind of reinforced a theme in the Brian character that's always intrigued me, and that's his forever young attitude to life. It fit into this context, but it is a bit out of place with Brian, the CEO of Kinetic, because he's doing all grown-up things now and apparently isn't quite self-aware enough to know that he's 33 or 34 and not 21.
So what do you think hurt more, the radiation or the comment that he's not 21 anymore?
Probably the comment with Brian, right?
That's what I was thinking too. But yeah, I mean, to further your point, I mean, he even has that comment when he was talking about the gym. He says he doesn't go to the gym to be healthy. He goes to look good. Like, it's not about him maintaining an active lifestyle. It's not about him maintaining an active lifestyle to be healthy. It's all in an effort to create this be part of that Brian Kenny persona. And sure, Now that's being taken away from him. And the fact that the doc is happy that he has gained a little weight, and that pisses Brian off. it's very interesting to watch that.
Why couldn't he have rationalized that though? Is like, I just had surgery. I've been laying around for a while. It's like, I can take these pounds off in no time. Instead, it's kind of reinforcing that cliched gay stereotype that you have to be thin and beautiful forever.
100%.
On the way to the social gym, there was a sidewalk scene. We haven't had one of these in a long time. There was a lot of exteriors in this episode, One of them had like five main characters walking down the street together. They're all going to spin class, which wasn't quite a social gym, but it was close enough. And I like that everyone was taking a dig at Brian about either wrecking the fundraiser or not being in the ride or not being capable of doing physical activity. It was like the airplane scene that you've talked about before. Everybody had to like
everyone's getting their whack in.
Right.
Yes, and I love that they're going to the So Cycle before Soul Cycle kind of business.
Yeah, years ahead of its time.
Yes.
So Brian and Mr. Remsen of Remsen Pharmaceuticals, I don't think he was quite introduced that way. At first, I was like, who the hell is that guy? And I was like,
Thank you. I was going like, who's this random dude that they brought to the hospice? Right. What's going on here?
Did you see the first extra at the hospice that kind of slowly slid across the screen? It was like a Walking Dead character.
Yes, with the IV bag.
Yeah, I know it's a hospice and everything, but I think they tried way too hard with the extras and the slow motion people there. It's like, we know it's a hospice.
Yeah, it's like it felt like they were really trying to sell dying.
And like miserable death too, and that's not what hospice is about. Hospice isn't about miserable death. It's about death with dignity.
Making you as comfortable as possible. And it's just, yeah, it was very strange. Like that doesn't inspire any type of confidence that they're doing good work there.
Brian is pounding the hell out of Justin. And we haven't had one of these fast-paced, cut-to-the-music sex scenes in quite a while, and I loved it.
This was like season one, you know, the kinetic editing and the music and the overselling of the sex.
I think we took identical notes. You're going like down my entire bullet list here.
Am I really? Oh.
Well, I've got one. I want to see if it was on your list. Did you notice that Justin is no longer shaving his butt? Was that on your list?
Oh, I didn't notice that. Good for him.
Yeah, there's a couple of like over-the-shoulder shots where we get Justin's ass and Brian's ass, and you can see that Justin's is no longer twink smooth.
We all love a little fuzz on the peach, so good for him. But what I love that... Brian, who is, you know, recovering from cancer, is still just lighting up a cigarette because I'm sure that's really good for his recovery.
I think that's one of those things like if you have cancer, it's like cancer, not lung cancer. It's like a cigarette. It's probably the least of your concerns at that moment. So why not?
No, I'm surprised that wasn't. I'm surprised that wasn't part of his doc going like,
yeah, quit smoking.
Stop smoking.
Right. This was 2004, though. Everybody smoked back then. You'd come home from the gay bar like a chimney. It was terrible.
Ugh. I'm trying to figure this out because he does have that moment where he brings a guy from the pharmaceutical company to the hospice in order to sponsor someone on the ride. But is he really trying to do the ride for the hospice, or is he doing the ride to prove that he's still the young, virile Brian Kenny that everyone knows?
Oh, well, it's both, as we found out a little bit later in the diner with a little bit of double entendre dialogue.
We just heard that Remsen Pharmaceuticals is sponsoring the ride to the tune of 100 Gs.
Oh. Will wonders never cease?
We didn't say anything, of course.
Have been trained never to divulge information under penalty of death, but it has the fingerprints of one Brian Kenny all over it.
Now you can forget about the ride.
Take care of yourself.
Ted and Justin realize that, gee, who did this come from? And so there's that. It's where Brian wanted to make good on kind of wrecking the fundraiser because he outed Jeffrey Pendergrass, who took all the money and left town. So he seems to have a conscience around that, and he wants to solve that problem. But then he also has this desire to be old Brian again and get back in shape. The weird thing is that he would have gotten back into shape anyway. He didn't have to have this ride to get him there. It's like after surgery, you have a program. If you stick to your program, you get back into shape. You can work up to it. You don't need like a fundraiser to do it.
Well, and we saw in the sex scene, it's not like he let his body go.
Yeah, right. Not by any means.
Like when he says that he gained a little weight, it looks like he maybe gained 5 pounds. I'm not understanding his struggle right now, but okay.
So they go to spin class, and this was literally just like the spin classes at my local social gym, complete with the hunky instructor and the okay, everybody, to get it started.
Yes, and they do it to the rhythm of the song and everything. Yeah. Turn it up.
Brian was a total idiot for just jumping right into this, though. Anyone that has been as active as he has been for years, I mean, he has a treadmill in his loft. he would know that he can't just like jump on a bike and like do a high intensity cardio workout with people that have been training for a while. I mean, this was like the advanced class. He should have been like in the beginner class.
I learned that firsthand. The very first time I ever did the spin class, it was after I had not been working out for a while. And I made it about 10 minutes before I had to unlock myself from the bike, go throw up. And you know what I did though? I got right back on the bike and finished the class.
I thought you were going to say you went down to the steam room.
Nope. But I will say after that, I really enjoyed it. Now, of course, I can't do it, but.
Yeah, but if you were going to start to, you would work into it. You wouldn't.
Absolutely. It's like, okay, let me try and push myself, but not too far to where I'm like, oh my God, I could never do that again. I don't want to hurt myself doing it. But you have to learn where it's okay to healthily push yourself, but then also know when you can't overexert yourself.
It would have been one thing if we had seen, if like spinning was like a big part of Brian's life for the past three seasons, but he has never been to a spin class in his life. We've only seen him like at the social gym, occasionally on the elliptical and on the treadmill in his loft. So
I was gonna say he never even really like spots anyone at the gym. So I never even see him lift.
Yeah, he just kind of lays there and snarks at people, which I like.
And cruises.
Right.
That's it.
And fucks.
Yeah.
So Debbie convinces Brian to give them all a big fuck you.
There is an alternative to going out in the blaze of glory. And that's giving them all the big fuck you. You know that I always say it was because of me that Vic survived those last 4 years. Because I bathed him, I fed him.
Wiped his ass.
You're right. But the truth is, Vic fought like a son of a bitch. Every time a new infection hit or some new med would make him feel worse than what he was supposed to be curing, he would dig down into some unfathomable place in himself and say, I'm not giving up yet, so fuck off.
This was the moment that Brian decided to do what he needed to do, which is to train. It took Debbie to channel a Vic story about getting busy living instead of getting busy dying. This story was a little forgetful, though, because she's talking about how Vic never gave up, how Vic would face every challenge head on. But in previous episodes, we've been told that he did give up and he went on a lavish credit card laden trip to die in Italy.
Before, but then he lived.
Yeah, before his protease inhibitors kicked in. And yeah. So it's a little bit of Vic revisionist history or retro continuity. And I'm like, leave Vic alone.
He died.
Yeah, I'm okay honoring Vic. In his legacy here, but she just made up a whole bunch of shit.
For the convenience to make Brian better.
Yeah. So I guess in that sense, that plays into what we'd seen Vic doing in like several past episodes with his ray gun and his Babylon full of older men. So this kind of tied up that story. It would have been nice if Vic himself did it though, instead of Debbie recanting the story.
Mm-hmm.
Recounting the story. She didn't recant it. She made it up.
But yeah, it would have been nice after we've seen that device of Vic causing pain to Brian.
Right, right.
To then say, okay, here's a way to start healing yourself.
So Brian that night goes in, or a couple nights later, goes and works out alone. So does Brian have keys to the spins facility?
Thank you. I didn't understand this. He somehow got into that spin class all on his own because it didn't look, that looked like it was not part of the gym, but was actually part of one other business.
Maybe it's an amenity in his building. Is that his building?
No, I would be shocked if that a building so happened to have a spin class business right as right. Part of it.
And where was the instructor? This scene could have added a lot of double entendre to it. If we see Brian in the spin class, then we see the spin instructor, like the same hunky spin instructor up there leading Brian in a kind of a cute little wink and a nod, like, yeah, we're going to spin and then I'm going to like fuck your brains out in the steam room.
That would have been infinitely more interesting.
Missed opportunity.
Oh, well.
So final runner of the night, Emmett and Drew Boyd, your favorite subject.
Yes.
And Drew and Ted are... Drew and Ted. Ted and... Emmett and Ted are going to have lunch. God, I can't believe I wrote that down.
But I can see how, because Drew is everywhere.
Yes. First off, though, did you notice that Emmett's costumes are amazing once again?
Costumed great, yet again, is my first note about this scene.
Yes. I don't know what happened at this point. There was some turning point in season four where Peter Page must have said, you know what? These costumes are not cutting it for Emmett. We need to up the game here. And so Patrick Antosh said, you got it. And just like put his all into it. Exactly.
And just like nails it. And he looks amazing yet again.
Yes. Second thing about this walk down the street was I didn't realize how tall Emmett is next to Ted. He towers over him in a couple of shots, like a foot taller. I never noticed that before.
That's just like, it feels like it's almost an effort to continue to make Ted feel like he is absolutely the weaker man.
Just make him shorter.
Just make him smaller. And did you catch that Emmett explains how hung Drew was?
Have to admit, it hasn't been easy. After all, how many times in life do you get to live out a fantasy? Ride your back end three times a week with this rock-hard 10-inch battering ram until your screams of ecstasy fill an entire stadium.
How did I miss that?
Yeah, he describes him as 10 inches, and what always boggles my mind is that everyone in this show manages to be super hung, except for the guy that's in the pilot who has all the accoutrements in his pants to make him look better.
So later we find Drew circling the block of Emmett's house. And I like the staging, even though Debbie was just kind of comic relief.
This black Hummer is just continues circling the block, circle the block. Right.
I liked Emmett's balls and just like walking up and knocking on the window and yelling at the car. And then when that window came down, it's like, oh, and those Druzy eyes. I was like, oh my God, this is staged so well.
And this big Hummer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, one thing though, why did Drew have to tail Emmett at like 2 miles an hour and rev the engine like that? Why couldn't he just like open the window when Emmett came out of the house and said, hi?
I don't know.
Why did he need to like circle the block too? Why not just park, right?
It almost felt like a game to him.
Well, surely Emmett had to have known what Drew drives by that time after a dozen fucks, right? I mean, they show up at the motel, they do their business. Do they leave at the motel? Does Emmett see him get into the black SUV? Does he give him a ride home?
I mean, maybe Drew always left first, or maybe Emmett always left first. I don't know. To make sure they didn't leave together.
It was funny because as soon as we see that Hummer circling the block and Debbie freaking out, I'm like, that's Drew Boyd. It's like, oh, of course it is. Who else could it be, right?
Yes, exactly.
And it was cute when they were kissing in the Hummer. Drew's worried that somebody could see them, and he says, no, the windows are tinted, but the front windshield is not tinted at all. So like when they have that shot from the back seat looking out the front, it looks like the whole neighborhood could see him.
Could easily see Drew deep tonguing Emmett right there.
But still, I liked it. It was really cute.
But yeah, him saying that like, no, I miss you, and that he was willing to take Emmett out. I found that so adorable. I was like, yes.
So dinner and dancing. Dinner and or dancing with Drew. The dream sequence at Babylon was great. Emmett looked amazing. He had like that nice guy liner on and everything. This got me thinking though, like in the last episode, we kind of ID'd Drew Boyd as like a Tom Brady caliber person. If Tom Brady went to a gay bar, how many gays do you think would recognize him? Like without a helmet on?
Agreed. Yes. And I feel like we got a little bit of that, but I thought it was going to be a lot more. Like as soon as Emmett walks in with Drew, both wearing sleeveless shirts, which I thought there were far too many sleeveless moments in the costume here. It was just
I was okay with that.
It was tacky.
Reminds me of 2000s.
But it felt like the gag of the season where it's like, oh my God, Emmett is showing up to Babylon with Drew Boyd. But I was hoping there'd be more of like, oh my God, like the only people who truly had like a holy hell, is that really happening? Was Brian and Ted and Justin. And Justin had a great slow-mo wow.
Well, for all we know, Brian and Ted are the only one that knows who he is, right? It's like maybe everybody else in the bar thought he was just like a really, really hot guy.
But like at this point, we know that his ads are everywhere.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. So, all of Pittsburgh knows who he is.
Right. So everyone would have known. They're like, oh my God, it's Drew Boyd from the underwear ad. At least that's how all the gays would have known it.
Yeah.
So I thought that was, and then we discover, yes, it's all just this dream.
Which was a good contrast to what their date night really was. So Drew buys out the restaurant so that nobody would see him. But like 50 people have got to work at a restaurant like that. So wouldn't news have gotten like, out anyway?
Like there's the waiter there. There's the maitre d'. There's the cook. Yeah. There are people who are going like, yes. Like you would think there'd be people who would be, well, then again, we don't have the internet the way we do now where people could easily
tip off the paparazzi.
Exactly. We don't have that here.
I did like that that quick cut where Drew snatched a gigantic piece of chicken off of Emmett's plate. It's like, are you going to eat this? No. And Drew's like, just grabs it.
You forget how much of a...
he's on a high protein diet.
I don't want to say Neanderthal, but like he is not as refined as, say, Emmett is.
I thought a funny part of this story was Sierra calls Emmett, and I couldn't believe for a second that Emmett agreed to meet up with Sierra without knowing what it was about, to say nothing of the fact that he just got ungrounded by Drew. It's like, remember, Drew was ignoring him? And he just gets ungrounded. So Drew's wife calls him. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll meet up for lunch.
Yeah, he makes it sound like, all right, I'm ready to take my medicine and know that she knows and it's going to happen. And I owe her the courtesy. I think maybe that's the Southern.
Oh, maybe that's what it was.
The Southern gentleman in him, that he owes that to her. But you're right in that he all too well wanted to meet up with her.
Yeah, best defense, not be there, right?
Yeah.
It was good writing, though. And I like the suspense that kind of built up with Emmett. By the way, we never hear from Sierra again. This is her last episode. She's gone.
Yes, and so she asks him to plan the wedding. Oh,
I do like that obvious thing. Like I've mentioned in the past, I like how we as an audience will know things that characters don't. And so I liked seeing Sierra going through all of this, not knowing that her fiance, about to be husband, is just gaining... like down and dirty with the wedding planner. I like that.
Which is usually how it goes, but it's usually a twist when it's another guy.
Yeah, sure. Right.
But yeah, let's get into this final moment.
The motel farewell.
Yeah.
This was good writing. It got me thinking that this is basically a coming out story. This is Drew's like story of coming out. And we haven't had one of these in Queer as Folk since Justin came out in season one. Seeing an adult coming out and having that story woven in the show is quite interesting, considering some of the other kind of lame or boneheaded things that make its way into the show. So I was kind of into this like grown man coming out type of thing.
And I think because it spoke to his fears very truthfully, in that he has everything he has in this life is based on this identity. And what happens when that identity is so drastically shifted? He sees it as he could lose. It's not just about him feeling like he's less of a man, to put it. It's like, no, I could lose my livelihood. I could lose the thing that I've been most passionate about in my life. I could lose quite literally everything. And I love that Emmett is able to acknowledge that, but then also understand what his worth is when he tells him that I've never had to live a lie and I'm not about to start.
Yeah, I mean, Drew is in a no-win situation here that pretty much any gay man goes through when they're trying to come out. What's interesting is that Emmett just isn't at all interested in going along with that for the ride. I kind of thought for a moment he would be, like he could sculpt this statuesque man into like a perfect gay, but he's like, he could have helped him and ease him through this though, while at the same time maintain his own belief system. But for drama purposes, I did like that. He's like, no.
Yeah, there's this moment. It's a realization of self-acceptance that Emmett is like, basically saying like, I couldn't go back in the closet or be someone's secret for anything.
I might have tried to work it out with Drew though. I might have stuck around a little bit longer.
Sure.
Okay, tops and bottoms for this episode. What's your first top, Matt?
I would say my first top, because I have two, the handling of Hunter's HIV status. I thought that whole storyline was handled overall very well. Loved Harris Allen's work with it. And I really found the consoling that happened in Hunter's room very touching. And it felt like the show was actually trying to be very knowledgeable in how this information gets handled. And how education and how proper education really matters in a situation like this. And I would say that my other top, and this sounds a little crazy, but it's Emmett ending things with Drew. And I think it's mainly because of what I was speaking to earlier, and that Emmett understands what his worth is, and that he knows that this will have to be a journey for Drew to go on, and that while he could possibly be support, that it is not worth it for Emmett to somehow concoct a lie for himself, because he's never had to do that and he won't start now. And I really loved that.
My top was kind of keeping in with your first top. Only I was a little more specific that it's Harris Allen. He killed it in this episode. Every scene he had was amazing, and he delivered just such a convincing performance, including the ones that you mentioned. So I just think that he was the big hit in the entire show this time. What's your bottom?
I think the bottom for me was Brian deciding that he's going to do the Liberty Ride.
Really?
I will tell you, because dramatically, I honestly didn't want to pay much attention to it. I wasn't invested in it dramatically. So I think that's why it was a bottom for me. Like, I think if we had done this and you had never mentioned the whole Liberty Ride or Jeffrey Prendergast, I would have forgotten that it happened.
That's true. That was a pretty, like, story.
I think we had so many other good things happening that Brian just took such a back seat in this episode that I just, it just didn't do anything for me.
Well, it was a runner on purpose because next episode, that storyline takes off quite a bit. So my bottom here was Melanie making it about Lindsay being with a man, not cheating on her.
That's a good one.
Cheating should have been the driving factor here. But while Melanie is entitled to that opinion, she's wrong. Thank you.
And you're entitled to your wrong opinion. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
This has been episode. Did you do your bottom?
Yes.
Okay. I lost track of where you were.
Brian doing the
right.
See, it's that forgettable.
Yes. This has been episode 12 of season 4, Irritation and Separation. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, Melanie takes revenge on Lindsay by becoming a pregnant, bedridden tyrant. Not two, but four characters contemplate marriage, and everyone except Justin gets on a school bus to drive to Canada, where the Liberty Ride will kick off. Justin is off to Hollywood to begin work on Rage. I guess Michael isn't needed for that particular story. That's the penultimate episode of season 4, and it's called Proposal of Two Kinds.
Fresh reviews and ratings on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to us are much appreciated, so please take a moment and help us out. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
You can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall, and I'd love to connect with each and every one of you personally. Nobody has yet, though, by the way. Just saying. I've said this every time for like 3 years. Nobody's ever connected with me.
Really? Oh, I get messages.
Well, maybe they follow. They just don't have anything to say to me.
Maybe. I mean, I do. I have some messages I need to respond to, which you can always message me on Instagram and on Twitter at MatthewPD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I am Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. We hope you'll join us next week for a new episode. Still Queer as Folk was made with love in Chicago.